Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our November 10th, 11 a.m. service. Our guest speaker is Michael Dowd. His sermon title is, Not the Future We Ordered, Honoring Our Grief. The music following the sermon is Allegretto from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 8, performed by Akui Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
Our reading this morning is entitled, A Vision, and it's by Wendell Berry. If we will have the wisdom to survive, to stand like slow-growing trees on a ruined place, renewing, enriching it, if we will make our seasons welcome here, asking not too much of earth or heaven, then, a long time after we are dead, the lives our lives prepare will live here. Their houses strongly placed upon the valley's sides, fields and gardens rich in the windows. The river will run clear, as we will never know it, and over it, bird song, like a canopy. On the levels of the hills will be green meadows, stock bells in noon shade. On the steeps, where greed and ignorance cut down the old forest, a new forest will stand, its rich leaf fall, drifting on its roots. The veins of forgotten springs will have opened. Families will be singing in the fields, and in their voices, they will hear a music risen out of the ground. They will take nothing from that ground. They will not return, whatever the grief at parting. Memory, native to this valley, will spread over it like a grove. And memory will grow into legend, legend into song, song into sacrament. The abundance of this place, the songs of its people and its birds will be health and wisdom and indwelling light. This is no paradisal dream. Its hardship is its possibility.
Those of you that were at the first service will discover that this is going to be an entirely different sermon. Same title, different sermon. I like to do that just to keep it interesting for people who are both services. Not the future we ordered. Honoring our grief. I love the fact that what was included in the bulletin is a favorite quote from Joanna Macy, one of my great mentors. The depth of your grief is the measure of your love. I came here this morning with two different ideas about where I might want to go with the sermon. So I tried one of them out in the first service, and I really liked it. And so now I'm going to try out the other one, and I think you'll like it, but we'll see. We'll just have to see. Because in speaking about our times and speaking about what is unfolding and what we can pretty much count on, what's either inevitable or highly likely in the near to not too distant future. We are living in sobering times. We are living in challenging times. We are living in contracting times, and it turns out That's the most difficult time throughout human history when you look at all the different civilizations that we've known of and the difference between human-centered city-based civilizations and tribal indigenous sort of permaculture 1.0, you could say, but indigenous cultures that could live more or less sustainably for long periods of time because they lived in a way that was a blessing to the future. They lived in a pro-future way. They lived in a way that was also committed first and foremost to the well-being of everything that they depended upon. Turns out, the fundamental difference between sustainable and unsustainable cultures relates to whether we're accountable to the future or whether we are unaccountable to the future. Sustainable means accountable to the future. Unsustainable means unaccountable to the future, and virtually everything else is a footnote or a distraction. And so what I'd like to offer in these few minutes this morning are reflections on four questions that I think typify the kind of insanity that we now find ourselves in. Why is it that we're living in contracting times when virtually all of us in this room grew up in expanding times? Turns out that's what I meant when I said that the most difficult emotional time is when you're born into times of, ecologically, it's called carrying capacity surplus. That is, there's more than enough energy, more than enough resources, and you're born into that. And if your whole life is that, then all you know is progress. And progress isn't a belief, it's a fact. It's like you've experienced it in your life. Things are getting bigger, the pie is getting bigger, economy's growing, more resources, wealth grows. And it turns out that we have over 100 civilizations that have become great and collapsed, and we now understand the patterns, the dynamics of what leads that to be the case. And if you're born in times of contraction, see, we call it collapse, you know, the collapse of the Roman Empire. It took 320 years. It was a stair step, and there were partial recoveries. That's the way civilizations contract and collapse. Almost always. Unless, you know, they're wiped out by a a volcano or something. But it's called the long descent. It's catabolic collapse. City-based civilizations overextend what they can afford to maintain, and then they start eating themselves. So if you're born in times of contraction and your whole life you've known contraction, then times of regress is inevitable. Progress is seen through and is an illusion. But the most difficult time emotionally is when we're born in times of carrying capacity surplus, and in our lifetime it shifts and we're now in decline. Because then we keep comparing what we now see and what, like every season it seems to be getting worse, with what we knew growing up, and there's this disconnect, there's this heart, this yearning, and then we look at what our children and grandchildren are likely to experience, and it becomes truly depressing or angering or whatever, fear. The stages of grief, the classic Kubler-Ross stages of grief. So the four questions I want to just briefly touch on, and Darjamel and Barbara Cecil, who are going to be speaking here at the end of January, we had dinner with them last night. They're dear friends and colleagues. In fact, Sarah Baker, I just learned, Sarah wrote an introduction to Dar's sort of retirement announcement. And then when we found out that you were going to be here today, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, from Ohio, she just happens to be visiting Seattle. And I understand that she's looking for where she might live next. So feel free to talk to her afterwards. But the questions are that reflect a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. Does God exist or not? Can industrial civilization be saved or not? Are we going to go extinct or not? And is it too late? Is there any hope? So let me take those one at a time. First of all, what I consider is the insanity, but it's actually pretty common in collapsing cultures, is where you start seeing gods and goddesses interpreted literally as supernatural beings. So if you believe in the supernatural being, you're a theist. If you disbelieve in the supernatural being, you're an atheist. And both sides treat primary reality, that is the biosphere, the ecosphere, as a lesser it, not a greater thou. And it turns out that the fundamental thing that unites all sustainable civilizations, we don't know of any examples that are counter to this, is they treat the living world as a divine thou, or series of divine thous, but as something that they are dependent upon for their own well-being. So to even have a debate, does God exist or not, already reflects that we are steeped in a culture that treats primary reality as something other than primary. It's just a set of resources that we can take and a place for our waste, rather than our material creator, sustainer, and end. And that's not going to change in our lifetimes. I mean, if everybody you know all of a sudden started treating the biosphere as a greater thou, not a lesser it, whether we mythologize at it or use secular language, it doesn't matter. It's not going to change. We are already in the age of consequences. I love the quote from Robert Louis Stevenson. He says, "Sooner or later, we all sit down to a banquet of consequences." Well, given the fact that we've got about 6,000 or 7,000 years of anthropocentric, human-centered, city-based civilizations that go through these booms and busts as predictably as, you know, economic bubbles go through booms and busts, we know that that's going to happen. We are going to hit the wall. But what we can also know is that there can be a resurgence of genuine religiosity in religion and sustainable cultures. The fundamental role, and this comes out of 500 years of anthropological evidence. Teddy Goldsmith, in his masterful book, The Way, an Ecological Worldview, surveys this research over 500 years, and he defines religion as, or life ways, as the control mechanism of stable, sustainable cultures. That is, that moral voice of society that ensures that the future is not compromised by the present. It ensures accountability to the future upon pain of death or ostracizing in some cases. So religion has become so degraded because we've been living in these situations where most religious people, when they use the word God, they think of some supernatural being. So already we know that we're part of an unsustainable culture because the only God that matters is life, reality. In fact, let me give you my creed, since some of you are probably freaked out about God language. Let me just sort of soothe you and let you know where I'm coming from. This is my 6-point creed. Reality is my God. Evidence is my scripture. The epic of evolution is my creation story. Ecology is my theology. Integrity is my spiritual path, and by integrity, I mean the practices that help me live in right relationship to reality. So reality is my God, evidence is my scripture. Big history, or the epic of evolution, is my creation story, and ecology is my theology. Integrity is my spiritual path, and fostering accountability to the future is my mission. So that's where I'm coming from. So the second question is, can industrial civilization be saved? Can it evolve? Can it be transformed? The quick and easy answer is no. It's impossible. Because civilizations are built on a worldview that then the institutions of that worldview are founded on that worldview. And there has never been, for example, a market-based economy in the history of our species that didn't self-destruct. And what chance do you think that there's going to be any time in the next, say, 50 to 100 years that we're going to transform our global economic system from being a market-based economy? It can't happen. It won't happen. So the question isn't, are we going to hit the wall or not? The question is, after the rubble stops bouncing, then can we rebuild? Can we plant the seeds of healthy culture, healthy religiosity, healthy spirituality? That is a greening of religion, which is why I wear this green clergy shirt in the first place, is I'm committed to the greening of religion that is coming home. I call it the prodigal species. You know, yes, we've squandered our inheritance. Yes, we're waking up to our predicament in the pig pen. But hopefully we're coming home to reality. Whether we mythologize reality as God or whether we just speak of reality, it doesn't matter. So, what is it that we know about the rise and fall of previous civilizations? Well, it turns out that human-centeredness is one of the characteristics of every unsustainable civilization. It all becomes about us. It's all, I mean, Daniel Quinn called it totalitarian agriculture. See, there are sustainable forms of agriculture, that you, like permaculture 1.0, but and early horticulture, but it's living in a way that attends to the health and well-being of the living world, the soil, the forest, the water, the life, everything we depend upon. That's primary reality. It treats primary reality as primary in healthy cultures. Unsustainable cultures treat primary reality, as I already said, as merely resources and a place for our waste. And unsustainable cultures measure progress and well-being in human-centered terms. So GDP, or gross domestic product, gross national product, that's a human-centered measure. The only sane measure of progress from here out, in other words, if there were one change that we could make that would make the biggest difference and plant the biggest seeds so that on the other side of collapse, which is inevitable, healthy things can grow, is shifting from human-centered measures of well-being and progress to life-centered measures of well-being and progress. How well is the soil doing decade by decade? How well are the forests doing decade by decade? How are the other species doing decade by decade? How's the water systems that we depend upon? The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. In other words, it's life-centered measures of well-being is our only hope. And doing that is making the future our primary guiding principle. Once again, coming back to indigenous wisdom, which had a continuity with time. Indigenous peoples knew that when you died, you didn't just die, you became an ancestor. And then you were imaginatively consulted as an ancestor for the wisdom, and again, it's an imagination, but nonetheless, it's powerful in ritual, how to pass on the wisdom of how to live sustainably, faithfully. It's the opposite of the telephone game, so that your children could survive and live in right relationship to primary reality, the soil, the forest, the water, the life, and so on. Unsustainable cultures not only tend to have an otherworldly, supernatural understanding of the divine rather than an embodied sense of the biosphere, the ecosphere's divine, but they also tend to be human-centered, and they tend to measure things not in terms of the future. There's not a continuity with time because the secular religion of progress has you think that everything that led to you was just a stepping stone. You the best, right? So there's not that valuing, and there's not the commitment to the future. So industrial civilization, see, the other thing that's unfortunate is that when people debate, will our society, will civilization collapse or not, it misses the fact that we've been in collapse for decades. In fact, for some species, when you look at the collapse of certain species, we've been doing it for 40, 50 years. We start to see the degradation of the biosphere, the degradation of species. Since the 1970s, insects, all these other species have been not just declining, but sometimes in free fall. That's collapse. It turns out collapse has a very definite description. It's a collapse of complexity. It's a collapse of wealth defined ecologically, ecological wealth, not human-centered wealth, not things in a computer or money. So then the question becomes, if that's inevitable, if we are already decades into the process of catabolic collapse, if we're already into that process, will we go extinct or not? Well, the question is, of course we're going to go extinct. Whether that happens in 50 years or 5 million years remains to be seen, but no mammal our size lasts more than 5 or 6 million years at most before an asteroid or a supervolcano or something takes us out. And it's not because we're bad, it's just because that's what life is. That one of the reasons why Alan Weisman's book and then movies and everything done, The World Without Us, was so popular is because it allowed people to realize that even when humans go extinct, whether it's 5 years from now or 5 million years from now, life continues. Earth continues to turn on its axis, the moon continues to go around. The Milky Way does its thing. And everything happens and it continues. And it's not about us. Because if you take the big perspective on a 100-year timeline, like if you compress the history of the universe into 100 years, We only show up on the last week. The dinosaurs are here from May of 98 to July of 99. In fact, we've only been speaking, when I say we've only been here, humans, Homo habilis, walking upright using stone tools, that's on December 24th or 25th, but we've only been speaking symbolic words where words point to what they can never capture on the last day. You've got a 99-year, 364-day. We're on the last day, December 31st of the 99th year is when we've got Homo sapiens, symbolic speaking humans. And there is no way that we're going to last more than another week. Because a week is 2.8 million years. And even if we last 2 weeks, okay, whatever, then we will go extinct. And the thing is, Connie used to say, she's not a gambling woman, but she used to say that even if we destroy ourselves and we take many other species down with us, which is clearly the track we're on, her money is on raccoons to be the next self-reflexive intelligence, right? Because they've got the manual dexterity for you know, to create tools that can expand their senses and their powers and stuff like that. Dolphins are really, really smart, but they're not going to domesticate fire, and they're not going to create those kinds of tools. And one of our favorite authors, John Michael Greer, he actually agrees with Connie. He thinks that the descendants of the raccoons will be the second creature that comes to know that it knows. And he thinks that the third self-reflexive intelligence, the third technological creature, will be the descendants of the crows, the corvids, like 100 million years from now. And because in 100 million years, fossil fuels will have been replenished, petroleum will be replenished, they're going to, and because they're already into flying, the crows are going to get to the moon. The descendants of the crows, they're going to get to the moon. And because hubris, arrogance, is the main downfall of civilizations, and we assume species too, that when they get to the moon, they're going to realize that some now extinct Earth species beat them to it. And maybe they don't have a favored relationship with whatever their crow imagining of reality is, and that will be the humbling that they need. My point is simply this. Of course we're going to go extinct. We don't know if the Arctic wigs out in some really serious ways when there's no more ice in September and all that heat goes into the ocean and it releases more methane, things could wig out so bad that our species goes extinct in the next 50 years. That's a possibility. But it's also possible we could last. There could be pockets of humanity that last for another million or 2 million years. But it's not going to be much beyond that. And then life goes on. Gaia goes on. Reality goes on. So it's not all about us. And that can really, it's kind of like Roy Scranton wrote a best-selling book that became a New York Times bestseller called We're Doomed, Now What? And he tells the story about serving in Iraq where he was out there in situations where he was actually on the front lines just behind the dogs and he knew that he could be blown up at any time. And he said he had to already assume that he was dead. He said the only way I could cope was to assume that I'm already dead. 10 years ago, this month, I went through cancer treatment at Whidbey Island. I was treated in the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And we looked at the possibility that if the chemo didn't work, I was going to die within a year. And so I got my head and heart around the possibility that I could die really soon. And the amazing thing is, when you've accepted the reality of your own mortality, and it's even better when you accept the reality of our species' mortality, your activism comes from a different place. You're not fear-based, you're compassion and generosity-based. It's a profoundly deeper orientation of activism. It's what Joanna Macy calls active hope. Not because hope is not neutral. Hope is like liquid. Do you have hope? Do you have liquid? Well, some liquids will kill you. Some liquids will sustain you. So some hopes will have us live in an anti-future way, in a wasteful way. And yet some liquids can sustain us. There are some forms of hope. In fact, I love William Catton, the author of the most important book I've ever read in my life, Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change. His definition of hope, or his statement that has hope, is what I'm grounded in. He says this, human self-restraint practice both individually and especially collectively, is our indispensable hope. It's that downshifting. So, the biosphere is divine, whether you mythologize that or not. Of course industrial civilization is going to hit the wall. We're already in the Wile E. Coyote moment. You know, we're already off the cliff. We just haven't realized it yet, and we're afraid to look down, because once we do, we're going down, right? So then the final question is it too late? Is there any hope? Well, I've already begun touching on it, but it's too late for some things, and it's definitely not too late for many, many other things. Is it too late to save global capitalism from the consequences of its own action? Yep. Is it too late for 7 billion people to find a way to live sustainably? Yes. I could go on and on. There's lots of things that it's too late for. Is it too late to have meaningful work, inspiring work, soul-nourishing work that gives you joy? Absolutely not. Is it too late to be engaged in your community in ways that are the most meaningful of your entire life, no matter how old or young you are? No question. See, there are many things that when we downshift, when we build community, when we plant trees, when we take trees, Connie, my wife, is one of the point people in North America, in assisting trees in migrating north, because it turns out that the difference for thousands of species of native trees and shrubs on whether they go extinct in the next 100 years or whether they survive the next 100 years will depend on human beings that love that tree or love that shrub or love those plants and then take those seeds and plant them further north. This is not invasive. Trees have been doing that for millions of years with the glaciers. It's assisted migration. It's holy work that can give your life joy even in the midst of contraction, because that's the thing. We know a lot about contraction, and we know a lot evidentially about how to have great lives, healthy relationships, strong communities, actually far stronger communities in decline than in times of expansion, because we have to rely on each other. And so I want to conclude with one exercise that I invite you to consider doing. In fact, I don't invite you to consider it. I invite you to do it, which is take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle so you've got two columns. And on the left-hand side, list all the things that light you up, that give you joy, that give you a sense of energy and fulfillment and happiness, things that you're good at, things other people tell you that you're good at, etc. List it all. The top of that list, you put my great joy. The next side, the other side of the paper, you write all the things that you're aware of that you feel in your community or in the world where you feel the world's needs, where you feel the needs of your community. Not just where you intellectually know about it, but where does it hit you? Where do you get frustrated, angry, depressed, and especially where do you feel compassion? Where does your heart break over something that's happening in your community or in the world or what you know the future will need? And you list all that. So you got two lists, my great joy and the world's great needs. Then you just pay attention to your heart. You don't have to call it prayer or meditation if you don't want to. Just pay attention here. There's wisdom when we pay attention to this part of our body, because it turns out our heart is surrounded by neural tissue, thinking cells. And so we get guidance when we pay attention here. And what you're trying to do is play mix and match. Like, where are the intersections between what lights you up, what gives you joy, what gives you energy, and what the world's needs or your community's needs as you feel them? And those places where your joy and your community's needs intersect, that's your calling, that's your mission, that's your vocation, at least at this time. That's where you can be a blessing to others in a way that blesses you. And the thing that I consider grace, with a capital G, and again, I have no supernatural beliefs whatsoever, but I consider grace the fact that life is structured this way, that it's not just my good works that will ripple out. Haven't there been people in your life who have made a profound positive difference because of their lousy example? They were a total jerk, and you made some positive, sometimes life-changing choice as a result. Now, do you honestly think that you haven't been blessing others the same way? So again, follow where your joy and the world's needs intersect. Accept that collapse is inevitable. Hard times are really likely. And extinction is possible. And then find those places where you can be a blessing. I call it post-doom. I'm involved now in a series of conversations along with Barbara and Dar and Jem Bendel and a whole bunch of others. Joanna Macy, I just interviewed her recently. And I call, see, doom is, I'll conclude on this. Doom is the midpoint between denial and regeneration. See, that's what life does. Life regenerates. With or without us. Even when we go extinct, whenever that is, life will regenerate. And one of the things that gives me hope, genuinely, remember the 100-year timeline? Is that worst case scenario, let's say we have World War III and it goes nuclear. And all humans are wiped out. And 90% of the other species are wiped out, and all of our nuclear power plants just melt. By early February of the 101st year, or the 100th year, by early February, Earth will have fully recovered. And that gives me hope, because we're not going to see worst case scenario. We're not that stupid. We're not that evil. We can't do it that bad. And so that gives me hope. So doom is the midpoint between denial and regeneration. And most people are afraid to allow themselves to go to the place of doom because they're afraid they're going to, they think it's the end point. They think they're going to spend the rest of their lives in despair. And it turns out that's not the case. Because yes, you avoid the door because you see this door of doom and you see W-A-S-F. And of course, you know what that means. We are so... Right? But if you allow yourself to go through that door, it turns out there are spheres of gratitude that open up. And then you turn back and you look and it still says W-A-S-F, but now your emotional experience is, we are so fortunate to be alive at this time, to call, to stand with young people in their stand for intergenerational justice. Nothing is more holy than standing with young people in that stand, not just for social justice, as important as that is, but also intergenerational justice. And then to follow those places that give us joy, that are a blessing to others. I call it engage and invest in what's pro-future and soul-nourishing. And that's where the post-doom is all about. Post-doom is remembering who we are, that we are the universe becoming conscious of itself. We are nature becoming aware of itself. We're not separate from the universe. We're not separate from the body of life. Knowing that, remembering that, accepting what's inevitable, and then investing in what is pro-future and soul-nourishing. I'd like to conclude with a few quotes from some prophetic women. Clarissa Pinkola Estes says, "Do not lose heart. We are made. We were made for these times. Do not lose heart. We were made for these times." Joanna Macy, "This is a dark time filled with suffering and uncertainty. Like living cells in a larger body, it's natural that we feel the trauma of our world. So don't be afraid of the anguish you feel or the anger or the fear, because these responses arise from the depth of your caring and the truth of your interconnectedness with all beings. You don't need to do everything. Do what calls your heart. Effective action comes from love. It is unstoppable, and it is enough."